The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So my name is John McGoran. I'm the author of a bunch of books, Spliced and Splintered, and the third in my current trilogy, Spiked, is coming out in May. And I'm also co-host of a podcast on writing, the Liars Club Oddcast, which this will also be aired on. But you don't care about that, because you're here to see Owen Colfer. So, Owen Colfer is an author, screenwriter, playwright, soon-to-be film star, and former school teacher most famous for the internationally best-selling Artemis Fowl books, which have sold 25 million copies in 44 languages and is soon to be a major motion picture. In addition to the 8 Artemis Fowl books, including the recently released spin-off The Fowl Twins, as well as several related works, including companion novels, graphic novels, and short stories, Colfer has written 24 other books, including 2 Benny Shaw books, 3 Owen Colfer's Legends books, the Warp series, the Half Moon Investigation series, and for adults, the Daniel McAvoy crime novels, Plugged and Screwed. He has also written 3 books in the O'Brien Flyer series, Marvel's Iron Man, The Gauntlet, and the 6th and final book in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, And Another Thing. From 2014 to 2016, he was Ireland's Children's Laureate. Owen Colfer, welcome to Philadelphia.
Can you understand my Irish accent?
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. I did a show once, and not to drop names, but I will. It was with Roddy Doyle and Colin Farrell, and I was speaking last, and Roddy spoke, Colin spoke, and then I spoke, and then after was a question, and a lady put up her hand and said, "Mr. Colfer, your Irish accent is not very good." So. Sorry about that.
Everybody's a critic, right?
Yeah.
I was doing some, you know, research. So I know that you were a school teacher before you became a full-time author.
Yeah.
And you know, Artemis Fowl, the first book, blew up pretty quickly, right? I mean, it was.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, how long did you continue teaching after Artemis Fowl came out? And what was that like? Were you walking into school, the kids like suddenly giving you respect, or did it change things drastically?
I was hoping it would. I hoped that I would get instant respect from the kids. But for about 10 minutes, if you have kids, you know that if you do something cool, it's very short-lived and they don't respect you for very long. So no, the kids didn't. Actually, they thought that because I had a book published now, that they didn't have to do their homework. I don't know how they drew that correlation, but I would say, "Where's your homework?" They'd be like, "You've got a book published. Why? You wouldn't have time to read my homework." So, but I only taught for about, I think I finished out that year, and then after that, I went on tour for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so here we are.
Which ends tonight. And so you had a couple of books come out before then, right? But just within a year or two.
I had 6 books, but it was 3 novels and then 3 little picture books over in the space of about 3 years.
Uh-huh. And before Artemis Fowl.
Before Artemis Fowl. And they did fine in Ireland and Denmark, for some reason,
uh-huh.
And then nowhere else. And my wife read all my books, and she would tell me they were lovely and they're very nice. But when I wrote Artemis Fowl, she was all business. She just said, "Right, you have to get an agent now." Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. Because, you know, that just totally blows away any compliment you could get. It's just, right, I'm not talking about this, just get an agent. And so I did.
So you didn't have an agent for Artemis Fowl? You just submitted that yourself?
No, I didn't submit it. Jackie read it before I submitted it. So when she... Jackie's my first port of call, and when she said get an agent, then I I tried to get an agent before submitting it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, okay. And I managed to do that. So I rang an agency in London, and an Irish girl answered the phone, and I shamelessly went, like, full leprechaun. I was like, be garby Jesus. Wasn't that a lovely rainbow this morning over the cliffs? Over the cliffs of Moher. And she was like, okay, I get it. We're in the, from the same country. So she said that she would, she said her boss would take one novel on holidays. And I said, well, will you give her, for the love of St. Patrick, would you give her mine? And she said she would. So yeah, and then, so that agent flew over to Ireland and signed me up a couple of weeks later. So it all worked out really well.
So the agent flew to you?
Well, there was an Irish conference on, so she possibly would have been coming anyway, but I like to think she...
Yeah,
flew.
We'll go with that.
Let's go with that.
Yeah. So I'm going to jump around a little bit because okay. I've got like a bazillion questions and I know that I can't ask them all, so maybe later. So in 2008, you were commissioned to write the sixth Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy novel and another thing, several years after the death of the author and creator, Douglas Adams. I understand you were a big fan of the books. What kind of pressure was did you feel stepping into those shoes?
It was unbelievable pressure. I think initially when they asked me, it was Douglas's wife and daughter, like a combo team, asking me to do this, and it was, they were really nice people, but I did say no, and because I just felt nobody should do this.
It's, right.
It was my holy grail, the Hitchhiker's Guide, but then they asked again a week later, and I just had to do it. I mean, it would be like if you're a musician, you know, Paul McCartney sticking his head in the door and saying, "Do you want to come fill in for John for a week?"
Right.
So. I still don't know if it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. I mean, I did my very best with it, but the pressure of trying to write that was really crippling me creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And two things helped me over that. The first thing was Facebook. This was when Facebook was in its kind of infancy, and it wasn't so targeted. So when you were on Facebook and you had your 20 followers or whatever, on the side of the page, groups would come up mm-hmm. for you to join.
Right.
Clubs.
Yep.
Like, you know, do you love High School Musical? Click here, that kind of thing.
Are you a bot?
I'm a bot. So a club came up, you know, signed a petition to stop Owen Colfer writing The Hitchhiker. I thought, that's not even aimed at me. That's aimed at the world. So I joined. And it was great because initially I was being very mean. I was being, you know, I was trying to stand up for myself. I was saying, you know, he's not a bad guy. Give me a chance. You know, read some of my books. Don't just spew bile. But then that seemed quite lame to me. So I went the other way and I started really insulting myself. And, you know, I was...
You using your own name?
I was, but people don't read the names. They don't like... They wouldn't even make... They would think, oh, this guy is also called Owen Colfer. What a coincidence that is. But I was like, oh, he's, you know, I heard he's really small and he buys his jeans in the kids' department and, you know, really inventive insults. And then the Artemis Fowl people got on and started to defend me to me. And I realized none of this means anything. It is just... It's just fun for people. They don't necessarily believe it. But the real thing that got me over again was my wife, Jackie. I was, anyone who knows Hitchhiker's Guide, you know that there's a character called Zaphod Beeblebrox, mm-hmm. who's an amazing creation, and he has two heads. And that was a gag for Douglas. But I can't write like that. I have to follow it through. And so I decided it would be easier for me if he could talk to the other head. So I wanted to take the head off and put it in an orb that would, you know, float around. And I thought that would be funny. But I knew that purists would rightly be incensed that I was doing this. So I was of two minds.
About two heads.
Yeah, about two heads. Yeah. And I wish I'd thought of that. damn it. So I went into the kitchen, and Jackie was there. And like most Irish men, I don't want to tell people what my trouble is, because that would be weak. So I wanted to be dragged out of me, so I went around moping. And finally, Jackie snapped, and she said, "What? What is it?" And I said, "Okay, there's this two-headed fictional alien that I'm thinking of removing one of the heads, and I know some people in America, possibly San Diego, in July, will be really, really upset about that." And Jackie said, looked at me for a while, and then said something which I think is quite profound. And she said, "Well, I have to pick up the kids." And you can read a lot of things into that, but what I think she was trying to say kindly is, you know, get a real problem. And that really helped me. It really, like, freed me up, and I was able to go back out there and just look at the, you know, at the fun side, and to appreciate the honor of being asked to do it. But I was very clear to the publishers then that this is not an official, you know, conclusion to Hitchhiker. This is legal fan fiction. That's what it is. And I think everyone should do it. You know, we should have someone else to do it in 5 years and just keep the Hitchhiker up there. You know, just get Neil Gaiman to do one, or get whoever.
Yeah.
Okay, calm down. No, I love Neil. I do. Yeah. One of the best moments of my, I was going to use this later, but it's come up now. I was in a hotel in London recently with Jackie again, and Neil Gaiman came over to me. He says, "Owen," I said, "Neil." He said, "Owen, can you come up to my room for 10 minutes? I said, "Neil, we met 4 times. I don't know if I can go up to your room for 10 minutes. But we went up. And
make it a half hour.
I can't, I couldn't, like, was Neil Gaiman's asking, come on, you don't know what's going to happen. You got to, whatever pain's involved, you got to take it. So I went up, and he showed me the first 10 minutes of Good Omens.
Oh, wow.
Before, you know, about 6 months before it came out. Mm-hmm. And I came down, and I think I was nearly crying.
Yeah.
Because that's such a favorite book of mine. And those guys, that's the only time the internet has agreed. Nobody, everyone loved that cast. Nobody said that these people are wrong, as far as I know. And I came down, I must have been ashen, and Jackie's just said, what happened to you up there? And I said, I saw 10 minutes of Good Omens. And she said, that doesn't mean anything to me. Just, is that a metaphor? So, I did love that series.
So did you know Doug Adams? Had you met him?
No, I hadn't met him. And just before he died, my agent had sent Artemis Fowl to him, hoping to get a cover quote, because it was reminiscent of him, because I was trying to be Douglas Adams. When I was in my teens, and I wasn't, you might find this hard to believe, but I wasn't part of the popular set. And the set I was in was the fantasy book series set. And we just loved these massive, big trilogies, you know, 600 pages each. And you would buy one, and then if you bought one, then you really had the whole series, because then everyone would buy one, and you'd swap them around. And so we loved all of those, and there's loads to choose from. And then one day my friend Ted, who's still a good friend of mine, came in with this little itty-bitty book, and he said, "This is called Hitchhikers." And we were like, "What kind of shit is that, Ted? I'll read that in, you know, recess." And then I read it, and my mind was opened. And what I realized was that you could be funny in a heretofore quite serious milieu or genre. And I think Terry Pratchett did that with fantasy. And those two guys, so when they came together and did Good Omens, or sorry, not those two, but when Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett did Good Omens, it was like my mind was blown. It was like when Queen and Bowie did Under Pressure. I just couldn't, I just could not believe it. So, but that changed my whole view on literature, because you didn't have to be the square-jawed, like every fantasy series I had read up to that point, a young man is working in a village, but he doesn't feel like he belongs in that family. He's actually really good looking, and his parents are ugly. He doesn't understand this. he's probably blonde. He's got a weird birthmark in the shape of a dragon. And then one day, an old man with a beard comes to town and says, you must come to me, you have a great destiny. And so he tells his parents, I'm out of here. They go to Dragon Mountain, he sticks his birthmark in the dragon, the mountain. That's actually not bad. Anyway, but when you read people like Terry Pratchett and Mort, for example, was the first Terry Pratchett book I ever read. And and Mort is just like this gangly kid. He has no real talent discernible. And I thought, I could be Mort. And that's this is really funny. And I really connect with this. And I decided, you know, this is it for me from now on. This is how I'm going to work. I'm going to go into a genre that is very serious and make it funny like no one has done before, except all these people that I love. That I love. So, and I've tried to write serious books since then, but it has never really worked for me.
Have you? So have I haven't read all of your books. You got a lot of books.
Yeah.
I mean, Plugged and Screwed were both humorous, right?
Yeah, they were humorous. I mean, it's a very dark kind of humor, Plugged and Screwed. I mean, I think the closest In Bruges is kind of in that vein. So they're funny, but they're very dark. And I think Highfire is like that too. It's funny, but it's dark comedy, I hope.
Yeah, but it is funny. It is funny. So the books that you've written that weren't intentionally, specifically humorous.
Yeah.
Were any of those published?
No, I never managed to get through. I think it's something about being nervous. I get nervous if no one is laughing. Mm-hmm. And thank you. And and I have to pop in a joke, and that used to really get me in trouble in school because I couldn't. Some of those guys, you drive teachers crazy because I just couldn't let them give the lesson. I had to interrupt with a little witticism, which
I mean, they're up there just giving you straight lines, right?
Yeah,
you
know? I mean, and I made the huge mistake with my son, who's hilarious, Finn, and I said to him years ago, he's 22 now, so this must be like 15 years ago, I said, Finn, if you're ever in trouble and I catch you and then you can make me laugh, then you're out of trouble. And that has backfired on me. Like, I would go in, he'd be punching his little brother in the face. And I would say, what's going on here? And he would moonwalk. I would laugh. And he's out. So never. That's a bit of parenting advice. Don't do that. That really didn't work.
So you've done some other stuff, outside of the universes that you have created. You did the Marvel, the Iron Man stuff. I would love to ask you about that. We don't have time, but I do want to ask you, how is it different when you're writing in a universe that you've created compared to when you're kind of playing in somebody else's sandbox?
When you're trying to initiate your own universe, you have to set up the universe. Mm-hmm. But with Iron Man, you're just able to first page, open the book, he flies off. Everybody knows who Iron Man is. And I remember, and everyone had seen the movies, and I remember Marvel saying to me, now, when you're writing this book, you're not writing about Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. You're writing about, like, the comic book side. And I said, okay, I'm not writing. And I am totally writing about, and I will stand up, I will tell you now, that's totally Robert Downey Jr. And I said, I think you'll find I didn't write about Robert Downey Jr. And they said, thank you very much. I'm convinced they never read it or anything.
Did you make them laugh? Did you make them laugh after you told them that?
No, yeah. With my nerves. I really enjoyed that though because I didn't have to explain anything. You just let them go, and everybody knows the characters along for the ride.
Did it feel different? Like, was your process different? Was the actual writing of it?
It was actually liberating in a way. I didn't feel the pressure to make the building, the House of Cards, stand up. Because so many people have written Iron Man. It's not like The Hitchhiker was a different, I really felt a lot of pressure for that. The only one where I feel I abjectly failed was I did a Doctor Who novella for, they were doing the 13 Doctors, I suppose it's 14 or 15 now, but any Doctor Who fans? Oh dear, okay. Nevertheless, I shall tell a story because I'm secure now at the age of 54. So I thought, Doctor Who fans, don't hate me, that it would be interesting exercise to write a Doctor Who novella having never seen an episode of Doctor Who in my life. So I thought, all I know about Doctor Who is when I walk past the television on the way to the bathroom or something and someone else was watching it. But I've never literally, and I still have not. So just from casual knowledge, is it possible to write a compelling novella? And apparently it is not. So I wrote this book, which I thought was great. It even had a funny title. It was called A Big Hand for the Doctor, because one of his hands gets amputated and they give him another one, but it's slightly bigger than this one. So I thought it was all based around that title, A Big Hand for the Doctor. And, you like it. I'm getting a bit of frost.
All the best things are based on puns.
Yeah,
you know.
My best friend in Wexford, he's a brilliant at giving you a bad review in a nice way, so you don't feel bad, but he gets his point across. Mm-hmm. And so he said to me, he said, you know that Doctor Who book you wrote? And I said, yeah. He said, well, that was the best Star Trek book I ever read. So basically, I just turned it into the sci-fi I did watch, which was Star Trek. So I get your point.
So it wasn't bad. It just wasn't Doctor Who.
Yeah, it was a good adventure story.
Yeah.
But I was just imagining Captain Kirk was a bit older, several thousand years older. That was with one hand. So, but it's worth seeking that out as a curiosity. But the good thing is, if you do get that book, there's 12 other amazing novellas in it, so including Neil Gaiman and a few other people. So it's worth hunting that down.
So you have you've done some screenwriting. You wrote the screenplay for Poison Pen, romantic comedy.
There was a master's course in Ireland of film studies, and as a thesis, the class had to make a movie. Mm-hmm. So they asked me to write something, and I said, "Oh no!" But I have this thing I never finished, which was called the Poison Pen, and I was expecting. You know the way you go to a school play, and we all know what we're expecting? That's what I was expecting. So I was trying to be busy for the premiere so I wouldn't have to see it. But I couldn't get out of it. I went, and it was really good. So they improved the script. They left my name on it, but they really improved it. So if you can hunt that down, it is funny. And the nicest thing is my brother Niall did the music. So that was a nice thing to do. So we got to work together, which we don't very often.
Have you done any other screenwriting?
I've done a little bit.
You've written plays.
I've written loads of plays. I really enjoy theater. It's very immediate. I like to sit behind the curtain, and there's usually a little spy hole, and you can watch people laughing. I had a musical that toured North America last year. It's touring again later this year. It's a Christmas show, so I don't write the music. I work with a guy, so it's fantastic. We were just talking about this. We both spend 10 months a year sitting in a room on our own. Mm-hmm. So it's great to get out and collaborate with people that you know and you trust. And one of the nice things about having a certain amount of success in one area is that I can ring most people and they will at least take the call. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing might come of it, but I managed to do a book with Oliver Jeffers and PJ Lynch and a few other people. So it's a great stepping stone. Mm-hmm. So that's nice. But I do like to retreat into the man cave, I suppose you call it. I do enjoy that solitude, and I think that is very important, that you can take that. And maybe that's why I'm sometimes nervous in public and have to make everybody laugh. But I do, when I walk into my office, I just sigh and put on some 1980s music. Mm-hmm. A bit of David Bowie, a bit of Kate Bush, a bit of Rush, and just, you know, relax and write. And it's a wonderful job if you can do it. If you're allowed to do it, mm-hmm. It's fantastic.
So having I'm always fascinated by writers who write with music on that has singing, that has words.
Yeah,
that doesn't get in your
it
head.
It does
at all?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes if I'm really trying to get into something, I would put on a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. some fantastic music and soundtracks. And but no, I do. If it's music I know well, I don't. It doesn't impact. Right. But if it's a new song and I'm trying to hear what he's saying, yeah, I couldn't work with mm-hmm. that. Yeah.
So the after Fits and Starts.
Yeah.
20 years. So the Artemis Fowl, you sold the movie rights before the book came out.
Yeah, that was, if you can imagine, you're working.
Well, I've imagined it.
Yeah, yeah. But I was working in writing in the baby's bedroom only when the baby was awake. So I didn't have access to the baby's bedroom. And the writing table was also the changing table. So there was the smell of, you know, I can only write now if I just pour talking powder on myself.
This manuscript stinks.
Yeah. And then to go from, and that's the way, and actually, I mean, I'm making that sound funny, but I really, that was great mm-hmm. to have that space. And then we got a phone call one day, and I was on yard duty in school, mm-hmm. In the infant yard. So there was like fluids everywhere. And the principal came out with the cordless phone, and usually that wouldn't happen. They would be told to call back. He's on yard duty. If any teacher's here, you know that. But he came out and he said, you should take this, Owen. And then the thing I have never heard a principal say, I'll take your yard duty. I thought, oh my God, my parents are dead. That's what I thought, you know, that's what you think when you get that kind of call or someone is injured. And it was just my agent, and she was like whispering, she said, okay, there's three studios bidding on your book. We'll know by end of business in Los Angeles. I was like, which book? What are you talking about? I don't have your manuscript. So Jackie and I just sat by the phone in our little house until, I don't know, what would close of business be in LA? I think be 4 a.m. or something, and waited for that phone call. And literally that phone call then kind of changed where our lives were going. So that was quite an important phone call.
Yeah, that's wild.
But we thought that they're going to start making that movie next week.
Yes.
And then...
Yeah.
But
you should be on your third reboot by now.
Yeah, I should be, yeah. Someone else should be playing me. So, but... It was 20, so it's 20 years, and it's coming out in May.
It's coming out in May, yeah, right, which is extremely exciting. So you've been a literary star for 20 years. I think it's, you know, safe to call you that. But movies are different from books.
Yeah.
So what's it like watching Kenneth Branagh direct Judi Dench in a story that you wrote?
Well, it's he's a genius and she's a genius, but I still worried because they rang me and said, well, we've cast someone as... Commander Root, the hurly burly man of action. I said, great, who have you cast there? And they said, well, Dame Judi Dench. And I said, oh, okay. I start getting a touch of the Rick Riordans. And they said, now don't say anything, we're just going to send you a scene. So they sent me a video, and it was just Judi Dench. Using an Irish kind of, she's going to do an Irish accent. Mm-hmm. So she was doing a few things, and she just started off and she just said, top of the morning. And it's the most aggressively violent, ominous top of the morning ever. Top of the morning is a happy phrase. So I thought, well, perfect. She's amazing. I could see what she was doing. Uh-huh. And she played completely into my darkly comedic nature. And, I think she probably could have played Artemis if she wanted.
Yeah.
So she's great, yeah. And that, after that, I relaxed. I said, okay, you guys do it. I really don't want to be involved. I just want to go on opening night. So that's my plan.
Yeah. So you haven't been involved, or have you been tempted to be involved in the screenwriting?
Well, no, because I had so much to do. I mean, I have so much... You know what it's like, we have to mm-hmm. finish books.
And yeah.
So I didn't have time to. As I get older, I find it very hard to come out of one project and into another project. Mm-hmm. So I really couldn't. But I did go over a couple of times and, just to rubber stamp it, I suppose. They liked to have me there. And they were so nice to me and my kids and my wife. So It was a lovely experience. Actually, now is a great time because you have this corona of a Disney movie coming out, but none of the, you know, people, none of the internet, shall we say.
Right.
So everyone is very nice at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm delighted. This part has been great.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, when the movie come out, it will be by and large positive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really enjoying this part.
Were there any, obviously the screenplay is never going to be the same as the book.
No.
Were there any decisions that the screenwriters made that kind of surprised you and that, you know, you were taken aback? And
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. They said, will we send you the shooting script? I said, no, I don't want to see it. I just want to be like, as we say, a punter, a customer. I just want to go in and enjoy it. Because I've had too many friends who really got involved,
mm-hmm.
and changed nothing. So I want to not get involved,
right.
and have the same effect. So, and also not, you know, feel that you're just banging your head against a brick wall. I don't think that would happen with them because they're actually very... Kenneth and his team is like a little cottage industry inside Disney,
mm-hmm.
That are kind of allowed to do their own thing. So... Mm-hmm. I just wanted to see what they can do. I mean, you can't really give art to an artist and say, don't change that.
Right.
So I want to see how they're going to interpret it. And I feel pretty confident they'll do a good job.
If they don't, there'll be a Facebook group you can join.
I will. That I will start. I will initiate that. Yeah.
So, but you've seen some of it because you're doing a cameo, right?
I did a few little things. I found it very hard to be an actor. They said, don't look at the camera.
Uh-huh.
And all I could do is look. I was like Schmeagol looking at a ring. I was like, and everywhere I looked, there was a camera. And I couldn't remember which camera I was not,
you were
to,
not
look
supposed
at.
To look at.
And the answer was all of the cameras. So, but I learned something about, you know, all these people who want to go into movies. It's not all glamour. Like, there was a guy there who had a degree from drama college, and his title was Wellington Boot Distressor. So he would take, when they were doing the farm scene, he would have to take the new Wellington boots and then sand them so they look like old Wellington boots. And he's thinking, 4 years of college. 4 years, and his dad is probably thinking 4 years of college. So it's not all. I mean, I don't think any of the other extras were treated like me. None of them got a trailer. They all sat together on a trailer, whereas I had a lovely trailer. So I was a little bit pampered, I think.
So we're running out of time a little bit, but I've got all these questions that I really want to ask, but I can't. But I did want to ask one thing before we get to our final segment. I've noticed that there's a lot of environmental themes in your books, and some of them are pretty low down, and some of them are pretty close to the top. What makes you feel compelled to address those issues, to include those issues, and has your kind of relationship to those issues changed in the 20 years? I mean, because I think our kind of relationship with the environment has changed over the last 20 years.
When it started out, I suppose I was teaching, and a big part of the curriculum would be the environment, and that's only growing, I think, in modern schools. So I would try and sneak in a few things into the books, and the point being that kids who might not necessarily read about the environment, they would accidentally learn about it through these books. And that's a great way to teach if kids don't know they're learning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know about your guys' kids, but my boys, I don't want to generalize, but it seems to me from a lot of years teaching that girls go to school, and boys find this hard to believe, girls go to school in order to learn stuff, whereas boys go to school to avoid learning stuff at all costs. And if my sons come home from school more stupid than they went in, that is a good day for them. So so often you won't get some of the students to read stuff that's about the environment, so you sneak it into the books. But then I found, even though I was putting it in the books, that it didn't work because they didn't believe it because it was in a fairy book. And they thought, yeah, there's not really nuclear submarines lying around in the Bay of Kola outside Murmansk. And I'm saying, no, there are nuclear submarines. They're just decaying up there. That is the biggest problem we have in the world right now, and no one knows about it. But they just didn't believe it. So eventually then, with my co-author Andrew Duncan and Giovanni Rigano, the artist, we've started this series of environmental graphic novels. And Andrew said, I said, why should we do this? Like, the first book was about the migration of young African kids up to Europe. Like, there's a million people crossing the Mediterranean every year. And I said, Andrew, you know, is this our story? And he was like, this is the world story. Mm. And we have 100,000 readers who will read it who might not ever watch the news. So we have to do it, which I thought was a bit melodramatic. But we did it anyway, and we're hoping, and that was illegal, it came out last year. And we're doing one next year called Global, and that's about global warming. So, and it's affected, because it's the kids, it's always mm-hmm. the kids who are on the front line. Mm-hmm. These little kids who have nothing to do with it, and don't know what's happening, they're the ones that are affected. So that's what we're trying to do with all these, to say how all these global catastrophes are affecting young kids who don't understand what's happening. So yeah, it's nice to be able to do ethical maybe books. I mean, there's still laughs though, mm-hmm. but it's nice to have that string to your bow. And what's really nice is that I possibly can get a bigger print run out of those than you would normally, which is great. So we're getting them out to schools and getting them out to more kids and, you know, helping out with charities, and it's all good. I'm trying to make up for something I did. I don't know what, but I must have done something, all this guilt.
Or something you're going to do.
Or something I will do, yeah.
That's almost all the time we have before we go to questions, but we do have one final segment. So I co-host a podcast called The Liars Club Podcast. We interview a lot of great writers like Owen on the show. And we always do a segment at the end, two lies and a truth, or two truths and a lie, depending on how you roll. And Owen has graciously agreed to join in. And instead of me and my co-hosts deciding or voting on which is going to be which, I'm going to ask you, with your applause, to let us know which of these things you think is true and which is a lie.
So I'm going to do two truths and a lie. And one of my truths was going to be Neil Gaiman's bedroom. But I blew that, so I will
have to... You can come up with a lie real quick.
Yeah, yeah. So two truths and a lie. Okay, so the first fact is that when I graduated from teacher training college, I wore one of Don Johnson's white jackets from Miami Vice. So that's possible. Mm-hmm. Now to Wexford, Ireland. So that is the first thing. Mm-hmm. The second thing is last week I had dinner with Claire Danes, and she told me what happens in the end of Homeland. Okay. And the third thing is I did a parachute jump, and I was involved in a tangled cable emergency during my descent.
Wow.
So that's the three things.
So two of these are true?
Two of those are true.
Okay, so our job is to try to determine which is the lie. So who here thinks that the Don Johnson jacket story is a lie?
It's growing.
Right. It's growing. Yeah, yeah. It's a slow burn with the Don Johnson jacket lies. Okay, and who thinks that the Claire Dane story is a lie? All right. And who
thinks... Now you people can spot a liar.
Who thinks that the parachute situation was a lie? Oh, so we have a clear winner.
Oh my God, I'm so transparent.
So is that the lie?
That is a lie. And you said something to me earlier that sometimes people try and kind of hide a lie.
Yes. So who did you really have dinner
with? No, I really had dinner with Claire Danes, but she didn't tell me the end. I begged her. And I wasn't just me and Claire Danes, it was a dinner party. But her husband was there and loads of other people. But I was like, come on, Claire, well, come on. Just. I'm amazed you guys all got that.
Yeah. The power of the crowd, you know?
I feel America's learned to spot a liar.
Yeah.
So.
Here's hoping.
There may be some way you can use that.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got some time to take questions from the audience, and we've got mics. The mic's going to come to you, so raise your hands and wait for the microphone to come to you and then ask your question into it.
So for writing High Fire, did you go and spend any time in Louisiana? Because it is highly descriptive and... Yeah. All of the different terminology and everything.
Yeah.
So I was really curious.
Can I?
That was one of my questions that I was going to ask that I didn't have time for, so thank you.
Can I still lie? No. No, I didn't go, but I spent a lot of time watching YouTube. And I was very worried about coming to America because I thought if I've messed this up now, it's kind of rude to come over here then and try and peddle it. But luckily... I've met three Cajun ladies in different places on this tour already, and they all said it was pretty accurate. There was one or two things they didn't say, we wouldn't really say that, but overall, and one of them actually lives on the Pearl River, so she said, yeah, it does describe it. But I'd spend a lot of time, and it's part of being a writer. You have to just inhabit, even if you don't get to go there, it's not possible.
Got to make stuff up?
Yeah. I mean, I can't really travel that much anymore because we have family situations where Jackie and I have to be at home most of the time. And for me to be here, I have to have cover in Ireland. So it's just not possible. So I just made it up. And this, luckily for me, the monster that, the fake monster that is in the book, which I kind of piggyback on, there was the Honey Island monster. That's what made me decide to set it there. I was looking for a legend of a monster so that if the real dragon was spotted, people would just think, oh, it's another fool who thinks he saw the monster and wouldn't believe it. And the Honey Island monster is quite famous. I don't know if you've heard that legend. Here's the actual legend. Don't blame me for this. In the 1940s, a circus train crashed into the Pearl River. This is true. A gorilla escaped from the circus train. That is also true. The gorilla then went and married an alligator, and they had a little gorilla-gator. That part may not be true. But the legend persists, and there's whole boat tours and books and everything, very entertaining stuff, and TV shows about this. So you can go on YouTube and follow the entire story. So that's what I did. So nearly everything that Squibb says or anybody says in the book is kind of has been said in another context by someone from Louisiana. So that's how I tried to. And also one of the editors in HarperCollins was also from Louisiana. So she was able to keep an eye on my grammar or lack of same.
Hi. You mentioned a fair amount of relatively recent sort of science fiction and fantasy. But I was also wondering if there's any that you would consider more vintage or 19th century that you feel was really influential on you.
I think, obviously, you've got stuff like Frankenstein, which is one of the greatest books, I think. And then more recently in the 60s, I loved Planet of the Apes, the original book. Pierre Boulle, which I think is fantastic. But I also loved all the serializations they did of the 1970s TV show. Does anyone remember that show? That was a great show. But there was a lot of novels.
Of the Planet of the Apes?
Yeah.
Really?
Did I imagine this? Come on, someone must have remembered that show with Galen and Urko and...
Fascinating.
Just me and you. It's like two of us.
You sure it wasn't just an
It
Ireland?
Was the biggest hit on television. It was a massive... Dr. Zaius, Go home and YouTube that tonight.
Right, with
Roddy McDowell.
Roddy
was in it.
Yeah.
And there was two astronauts, two very cool guys.
I do remember that now, yeah.
I loved that, and there was a lot of that kind of thing, which I love. But I think Frankenstein is credited with being the first mm-hmm. sci-fi novel. That was a huge influence on me. And the 70s was a great time for really bad special effects when you look at them now. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was like all these Ray Harryhausen movies. They were unbelievable. There's a skeleton moving. Oh, my God, it's magic. So, I loved all that stuff, and I still love it. I probably don't read as much now as I used to then. But comic books as well. I was a huge comic book fan, and there was three series. There was Creepy, Eerie, and Vampirella. And they were really hard to get in Ireland, but myself and my brother managed to get hold of them as much as we could. And the artwork was unbelievable. And they're still mining those, I think, for movie ideas, because they had great storylines in them.
Hello, longtime fan. So I was on Facebook the other day, and there was this little article, and it was talking about, oh my goodness, they're going to put like a video camera in like a contact lens, and obviously it sounds just like an iris cam.
Yes.
What does it feel like to you to see like some of the technology that the Lower Elements had, and it's now like coming true?
It's so weird because it's like, as I tell everyone, I actually did invent the iPhone, but nobody... but stuff like the iris cam, I think I just looked at what I go on the websites of what the latest thing is that's not out yet, and then I try to extrapolate on 50 years, and then usually it's like 6 months. I'm way off. I think it's fun, but I think they were probably thinking about that before I started doing it. But I think Douglas Adams, I think The Hitchhiker's Guide is probably, it's like Google really, isn't it? So I think he was the closest one there. I'm just kind of following in his footsteps. But it is funny when stuff comes and you've had it in book three. But it also makes your books very dated really quickly.
Yeah.
Because in one of the books, I think it was The Eternity Code, Artemis invented this little iPhone kind of thing. And he wasn't going to put it on the market, but he offered to keep it off the market if someone would pay him. And about a year later, the iPhone came out. And then my book didn't seem like edgy and futuristic. It seemed like it dated it. So you have to be careful, really, how you use that kind of thing. Although I don't mind them being of their time. I think it's kind of nice. And kids don't mind it either. It's like when they have cell phones in movies now. If they very obviously look at the cell phone and there's no signal, you know something's going to happen any minute that they will need. They will, oh no, my phone has suddenly gone out of charge. I'll just leave it in this very obvious place where it's just out of reach. And you know they're in big trouble because they would have needed that phone. So I like those, you know, those flash, those alarms in movies, quite funny.
We were talking beforehand about how grateful we are that you published, Artemis Fowl, the first book, and how it changed your life, and that's wonderful. But I'm wondering if there's a flip side to that. I mean, did you feel a burden or a pressure in having to keep writing them? I'm assuming that was there, you know. And did you intend to even write more than one?
No, I intended to write one, and I didn't really think it would be any more popular than my previous books. I had no reason to. You don't know what's going to hit and what's going to miss. I mean, I always think my books, the book I've just worked on, is great. But you go through these, I think most writers do. One minute you think you're fantastic, and the next minute you just think everything is terrible. But with Artemis, I thought, this is one book. No one's going to like a naughty kid as a hero. I think it's funny, but I don't think anyone else will like it. So when it became this mass, you know, a big hit, and the publishers wanted more, I wanted to do more, but I didn't want to do it just because the publishers wanted it. So I took some time out, and I put together a plan for two more. And when I felt they were good enough to stand on their own, then I went back to the publishers, and I did three, and then I agreed to do another three, and then I agreed to do another three, but I only did two. So, and I wouldn't do that much again. I think I'm doing the Foul Twins now, and I'll do three of those, and that will be it. And they're like, they're shorter books and they're funnier. But that it's a big undertaking, 8 books. It was like 15 years. And the only way I could keep going was to alternate. So I would do an Artemis book, and then I would do Airman or with the Wish List, or Plugged or Screwed or one of those in between. And that so when I went back to Artemis then, I'd be excited about it. So, but even to be speaking like this, it's incredibly privileged. Mm-hmm. And I know that that I'm able to do it for a living, and that people want more of the books that I write. So I'm not up here being all, you know, forgetting that or thinking that I should be allowed to moan like that. I mean, I do moan myself at home to myself in the office. And occasionally I meet, you know, myself, or maybe I might meet someone like Derek Landy, who does Skullduggery Pleasant, and we will sit together and moan. But we can only moan to each other. So we have to get it all out of our system.
And he says, I've got to go get the kids.
Yeah. And he doesn't even have kids, so it's a dead giveaway. So definitely 3.
So quick follow-up. Was there anything that you wrote in the Artemis Fowl books that you wish you hadn't, that kind of like painted you into a corner when you went to do a series?
Well, there was 2 ways to spell Artemis. There was Artemis with an I at the end, and IS, and then US. And US was the more accepted male version of the name. But I wanted IS because that's what they called boys as an honorary name if they were good hunters. Hmm. And I've had to explain that, I would say, 1,000 times. So sometimes I wish, just for handiness' sake, I just gone with the US. But most times I think, no, you're right to stick to that. But you do spend a large portion of your time every day explaining that.
Yeah.
So after 15 years, it gets a little tired of it.
So you've obviously know a lot of science fiction. You know historical fiction. You've talked about these stories that you've watched on TV.
Yeah.
You know all these people that write them. How the hell did you miss Doctor Who?
I know. if you weren't here earlier, that makes no sense. But I don't know. You know, sometimes you miss the start of a series, and then it's too late to jump on board. I felt it was too late. And we didn't get Doctor Who in Ireland until the 1980s. That boat had passed me by. But I'm feeling a certain anger. So I hope you can forgive me. I'm never doing that again. So, and then even when I did it, I didn't take it seriously. So I'm sorry about that. I do apologize. Don't tell David Tennant.
So you've sort of touched a bit on horror in your work. Like,
yeah.
I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but in a recent one, what HC did, RHM did to W, that was, one word would be horrific. And, you know, it kind of touched almost on the folk horror genre in the 3rd Plugged book.
Yeah.
So my curiosity is, are you going to do some more horror?
I do like horror, and I'd love to do more horror, but I just, and I will, but it'll be laced with humor, you know. I can't go, I'd love to be able to do that. But even Stephen King is quite funny. I mean, if you read Stephen King, he's got a lot of really good jokes in there. I think I'm trying to think of my favorite horror book. I think the graphic novel, the From Hell, that's probably my favorite one. I don't know who's read that and who hasn't read it, but it's quite amazing work of art and fiction. So yeah, I would like to do more. I'm trying to think of that. Like, horror is really high concept idea. And if you can come up with that high concept idea, like, you know, Candyman, say his name 3 times and he appears, like, that's fantastic. It sounds so simple, but to purify an idea down to one sentence that still holds up. I think there was a movie out last year called Ready or Not, which the idea was that you had to play a game, and if you drew hide and seek, then the family tried to kill you. That was a great movie. I really liked that. And there was one about alligators. I can't remember what that was called. Crawl Space. Okay. So it was Crawl Space was in The Simpsons.
Crawl Space was actually more of a Saw parody, but it was from Thailand. I guess it would be closer to the guinea pig movies from Japan or Hostel.
Okay, you've lost me a little bit, but I see. But I like, did you like that movie, the Crawl Space movie? Did you see that
I actually didn't see that one. I'm mostly thinking of Midsommar, which again is sort of in the folk horror genre.
Oh, I can't. I really get uncomfortable with these very, very scary movies. I'm like a bit of a wimp in that particular. I like, you know, kind of a little bit scary, not too scary. I think Midsommar is probably terrifying.
Yeah.
I would definitely not be watching that one.
Reading The Foul Twins was definitely like stepping completely back in time. And I'm kind of wondering what it was like for you to like enter back into this world, you know, since it hasn't been that way since 2012.
I so enjoyed writing The Foul Twins. I hadn't done anything in that world for 6 or 7 years. And I wanted to make it more gothic. So it's like higher adventure. I had done 8 books about a dwarf passing wind and without ever using the word fart. And I thought, enough of not using the word farts. I am going to. It was like when Queen finally decided to use synthesizers. Maybe that not as important as that. Maybe not that important. But for me, it was a big breakthrough. I felt great after it. I'm loving it, and it's so. I think sometimes when you're in the middle of writing a series, you just want to do something else that you, for some reason, think is more important. But then you just realize, you know what? I love writing that, and people really enjoy it, and I'm really proud of it, so let's do a few more. So it was. I'm really glad you enjoyed it, and I certainly am continuing. But I'll like to finish with a little story of what's so nice about the Artemis Fowl books in my mind. In my mind, there's a dad somewhere, and he goes home after a long day's work, and say it's yesterday, and he wants to watch the Super Bowl. And then his son or daughter says, Dad, story time, it's your turn. And he's like, oh. The last thing he wants is to read a chapter of some Irish guy's book about leprechauns. And I'm not happy about that, so I'm going to punish that dad. And here's how I do it. I put a joke in there that the dad will get, that the kid won't. The dad will laugh, and then he has to explain a very... inappropriate subject to the child. Now, this probably doesn't work as often as I think it's going to work, but it worked recently because a dad came to me and he, with grudging respect, and he told me what had happened, and this is what had happened. In the last Artemis Fowl book, there is a character called, who's a dwarf, okay? So not a human little person, a mythological dwarf, who, as we all know, mythological dwarves, they tunnel through the mud. So this dwarf's name was Colin. No problem there. Colin, very respectable name. Not funny at all. Now, I don't say the second name for a while. And Dad is reading. And I know, the dad doesn't know, and the kid doesn't know, that the dwarf's second name is Oscopy. So... See? You're way ahead of me. So this dad comes up to me and he goes, Hey! He said, I've got a bone to pick with you. I said, is it Colin? And he was like, yes. Yes. I said, tell me exactly what happened. Tell me exactly what happened. And he said, well, here's what happened. I'm reading about this dwarf. My son's lying there. He's 7, by the way. And I'm reading this story. I want to be downstairs watching the football. And I flip over the page, and I read, and from the deep, dark, smelly hole came colonoscopy. And I started laughing. And my son said to me, Dad, what's funny about colonoscopy? And the dad, with perfect timing and impeccable delivery, said, Son, there's nothing funny about colonoscopy. Which I thought was genius. So that's what's going on in my head. That's what I'm hoping happens, that you get that kind of connection with your kids. And it's a bit subversive, but totally harmless. If I could do that for the rest of my life, I would.
That's great. Thank you. That's great. I just want to thank you for that. That was tremendous. I want to thank the library for bringing you here and giving us a chance to talk. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.